Welcome to this special Think Tank edition of Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. As with our previous Think Tank adventures, we gathered a dozen elite clinical investigators to debate the most controversial areas in colorectal oncology. And as with our breast cancer Think Tank, we structure the meeting around recent publications and presentations, particularly from the 2006 ASCO meeting in Atlanta. To begin, Dr. Richard Goldberg, my co-chair again for this event, as with our prior think tanks, reviews two fascinating papers from ASCO that he and his group presented, evaluating the impact of chemotherapy based on race and age.
This work comes from the intergroup 9741 trial that so many oncologists participated in the late 90s and early 2000. This compared IFL, FOLFOX, or IROX. And we compared African-American to Caucasian patients with respect to response rate, time to progression, and overall survival, as well as toxicities. And then we also, on this study, looked at 21 different polymorphisms and key genes coding for enzymes involved in drug metabolism. And, of course, we wanted to try and correlate the clinical endpoints with the polymorphisms of the two different races that we compared. The analysis that we are doing looks at a comparison of 117 African-Americans to about 1,300 Caucasians, so about 8% of patients enrolled were African-Americans. And the response rate, surprisingly, for African-Americans, regardless of which of the three regimens that they were on, was lower than that of Caucasians, and significantly lower, 31% versus 41%. The time to progression was 7.3 months for the African-Americans compared to 8.2 months for the Caucasians, and overall survival differed also by about a month and a half in favor of the Caucasians. We also looked at toxicity, and that was a surprise as well. If one looks at any grade 3 or 4 or 5 toxicity, African-Americans had considerably less and significantly less toxicity than did Caucasians. The any grade 3 toxicity rate was 34% versus 48% for African-Americans versus Caucasians, and that was principally because African-Americans were less susceptible to severe diarrhea. 5% versus 17% had grade 3, 4 diarrhea. Now, the next study I want to talk about was a study that we put together and presented on pooled safety and efficacy analysis of FOLFOX4 in older patients compared to younger patients with colorectal cancer. If one looks at the disease-free survival in the adjuvant setting, comparing patients under 70 years of age to those over 70 years of age, the curves look exactly the same. The hazard ratio for the comparison of FOLFOX to 5-FU-leucovorin is 0.78 in the less than 70-year-olds and 0.71 in the 70-year-olds and greater. Now, if one also looks at adverse events, there were only two p-values that were significant in the comparison. That's for neutropenia and thrombocytopenia. Both of those were events that occurred on the CBC and didn't necessarily affect the patient in terms of symptoms or untoward outcomes. They did, in some cases, limit the drug dosing and required dose adjustments, however. If one looks at neurotoxicity, diarrhea, nausea and vomiting, and 60-day mortality, none of those were different in the younger versus older patient groups. So among patients entered into clinical trials, and obviously these are a selected group of patients, the conclusions were that younger and older patients accrue the same benefit from FOLFOX4. Elderly patients do not experience clinically meaningful increased toxicity. And age alone should not exclude an otherwise healthy older patient from receiving FOLFOX chemotherapy. Obviously, clinicians need to be judicious about what they choose to do for their older patients, but I would suspect that we are under-treating some of our older patients who could stand up to the rigors and accrue the benefit of combination chemotherapy.
Thanks, Rich. Axel?
One of the questions that I had, Rich, is whether we have clear data on the dose intensity on N9741 between African-Americans and Caucasians.
We have the data, we just haven't analyzed it. You know, I think it also is plausible that populations are often intermarried and genetically somewhat inbred and may well have different tolerabilities for different drugs. If one looks across the world, there have been now studies looking at polymorphisms in different populations, and Asians have very different genetic makeup than do Caucasians. We didn't have enough Asians in our study to look at this. But some of this may get at explaining things like what Dan Haller presented at ASCO, showing the variability and tolerance of capecitabine depending on where in the world you live.
Bob, I had one question for Rich, and that had to do with gender. Did you see any difference within the African Americans with regard to females versus males? As there's been sort of a tendency in some of the NSABP trials where there was more toxicity in the female population.
Bob, you know, we published some data on that using the Mayo regimen years ago, showing that women had more toxicity, more mucositis, and more neutropenia than men did. In this study, we looked at gender, not broken down by race, but just compared men and women, and the toxicity and activity by gender was no different. And so we didn't break it down by African American and Caucasian.
Neil? It's also curious that only one toxicity, the one that's most self-reported, diarrhea, and if you will, the least objective, was different between the two groups, which raises the question of whether there's a reporting bias. With regard to the differences in polymorphism frequencies, it's really key to have some sort of mechanistic understanding attached to that, because I guess if you surveyed all the people in 9741 and asked them whether they had Macintoshes or PCs and found that the African Americans were more likely to have Macintoshes, that doesn't prove that having a Macintosh causes diarrhea either. So these are provocative data, but there are a lot of levels that now need to be pursued to really confirm that the genetic findings are in some way related to diarrhea, or if they are.
Rich, should there evolve a different dose schedule for African-American patients, lower toxicity, lower response rate, or are they being undertreated?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, and I ended up getting into some conversations with Michelle Christian, who is at CTEP and who is African American, and she was very interested in this finding, wondered whether we ought to be specifically looking at trials in African Americans where dose escalation is part of what is asked in the questions that the research is being formed around. And again, I think this is preliminary data, but it perhaps should change our thinking and lead to further investigations as time goes on.
That's the key conclusion for this. I think this is very interesting, and I think it should stimulate a lot more work.
Charlie?
The response rate is certainly interesting, but obviously you're showing no significant difference in the more practical outcomes, namely time to progression and overall survival. So although it's interesting to consider whether we should dose escalate in African Americans, I think we shouldn't obviously let response necessarily drive that, because NSABP and 0089 both demonstrate that African Americans have exactly the same outcome as Caucasians. And then I think actually those two studies are interesting because they argue that when African Americans get access to good care through clinical trials, they have an identical survival.
Yeah.
Correct.
Al?
On a slightly different topic, Rich, we're obviously very interested in patients who can go on to liver resection after their first line therapy. And your numbers may be too small, but are these differences in response translating into who goes on to liver resection by race and who does not? Your numbers may be small, and I'm not aware if anyone's looked at a collection of patients.
We actually did look at the liver resection patients and lung resection patients in 9741, and 9741 was started in 1997, and at that time, the awareness of the potential for liver resection was not what it is today. Therefore, there was no formal policy in this protocol about liver resection. In the current intergroup study, 80405, there is a policy that patients should be evaluated by liver surgeons or thoracic surgeons often and taken to surgery whenever possible. Only 3% of the patients on 9741 went to resection. I would anticipate that in 80405, it's going to be more like 10 or 12%. Therefore, when you cut the numbers down, there really was not enough of a sample size, despite the large number of patients enrolled in this study, to do that sort of subset analysis.
Axel, we see both in the survey of this group as well as community oncologists that patients over age 80 are treated differently, a lot more fluoropyrimidine monotherapy, probably considerations for competing causes of mortality. What are your thoughts about this?
I mean, it might be right to treat a very elderly patient, over 80, over 90 perhaps, very differently. And I think there was even a presentation asked about the octogenarians and nonagenarians. patients who are very old. I think the challenge we're facing right now in our clinical trial system is we know that patients can tolerate our therapies, as demonstrated by Rich and other analysis, but we still don't see those patients enrolled in clinical trials. So the question is, should we design clinical trials specifically for the elderly, thereby kind of dispelling some myths on treatment tolerability, et cetera? Because this is actually an approach that is being done right now in lung cancer more than anywhere else because of toxicities involved with treatment of lung cancer patients and the necessity to have these patients participate in clinical trials, which I think is our challenge right now.
Howard? We did a study in ECOG 1299, which was for advanced colorectal cancer in patients older than 75 who were treated with UFT. And we presented a poster abstract at ASCO last year. So there were 55 patients that we accrued in 2 years, and the median age was 81. That's opposed to the median age of 59 in every other colorectal cancer trial. And they had pretty much the same toxicity and response rate that you would expect. Again, I think that this is more like a public service announcement that we need to convince our peers that people who are in good shape, even though they're in their 80s, deserve the same therapy. But as we develop less toxic therapies and more alternatives, I think people in practice are going to take the approach, first do no harm. I'd rather undertreat somebody and not make them sick. And it's a little hard to combat that kind of point of view unless you have specific data. And so that's why I think it is important to do trials in the elderly population. And I had a 90-year-old guy that I treated with FOLFOX for a while and then 5-FU, leucovorin, and Avastin for well over a year who functioned very well during that time. So,
Rich?
You know, I'd bring up a patient that I saw yesterday in clinic who was 80 and is a month out from a surgery, had peritoneal carcinomatosis. And I was sitting there as the chair of the CLGBGI committee saying, can I put this patient on 80405 where there's a one-third chance that she'd be randomized to take five drugs? And I didn't have the courage to do that. So what I ended up presenting to this patient is that we're going to start you out on 5-FU leucovorin and Avastin. And then if you tolerate that for two cycles, we're going to add oxaliplatin into it. And when we start the oxaliplatin, we're going to start out at 75% full dose. And if you tolerate that, then we'll go up to 100%. And so I think that one of the things that we have to do is not consider that the regimen that Amory's developed for 50-year-olds is exactly where we ought to start with 80 or 85-year-olds. You have the ability to fine-tune the regimen and use your patient as their own control to test what they can tolerate.
That's exactly what people do in practice because they don't want to make somebody sick. The worst thing you can do, as far as your nurse is concerned, is to make someone sick. But your data show you shouldn't do that.
Well, but I think that my data show you shouldn't do that in people who are enrolled in clinical trials. And
which
that's the crucial difference.
And what was the contraindication to this patient having been eligible for a clinical trial? Just because he had carcinomatosis?
It was my judgment that this patient was relatively robust as an 80-year-old, but was somewhat frail.
This little back and forth here is illustrative of a huge caveat of the data you present and the other data showing no difference in toxicity, and that is that the data do not include large numbers of patients who are in their 80s and 90s. The
right.
Patients on clinical trials that form the basis for these analyses, the old people are in their 70s, and they're not old.
Right.
And so what Rich is telling with his vignette is that, yeah, this person would have been eligible for a patient, and I know my own data, but in my heart, I believe that an extremely old person, maybe somebody in their 80s or 90s, may in fact not tolerate therapy as well. And that's not a contradiction of the data. The data do not include sufficient numbers of these patients. And I asked this question to Dan Sargent at ASCO. How many people in your data set, what percentage, were in their 80s or 90s? He hadn't done that analysis, but I bet it was a pretty small number.
Yeah. Steve, and then Dan?
Well, I just want to back up some of the things that Neil is saying and just take it from a surgical perspective. We've done many of the same types of trials in surgical groups of patients with primary colorectal cancer, liver metastases, even other malignancies, pancreas, gastroesophageal junction, et cetera. And all of those trials show the same thing, that there is no higher complication rate, no higher mortality rate related to the surgical procedures. But the key, again, is it's in highly selected patient populations. For patients to be included and for patients to be considered for those therapies, they pass the not only the gestalt test that Rich is talking about, like how does the patient look sitting in front of me, but they meet the criteria that we need. So I think unless we could look at a larger population that included all of the patients with their various comorbidities, it would be difficult to know, whether it be with surgical therapy, chemotherapy, exactly how there's going to be an impact based only on age, because we are being highly selective in the patients that we put onto these trials.
Final comment from Dan.
It would be nice to have the data to look at, and I don't know if a case control study, Charlie might better define it, comparing the host factors and the fit elderly who actually enter trials. So we had 1,000 of them over 70 in intergroup 089 with the average population to really help in the decision-making Rich is talking about, is using your clinical judgment. In that study, in fact, with 1,000 patients, although the final conclusion that Dan Sargent came up with was the elderly tolerated treatment just as well. The one big caveat is the one we've discussed, which these are the ones who made it through the hurdles. And the second one was they actually didn't do the same. It was like a non-inferiority study. They did worse in every aspect, but just not badly enough to say that it was clearly worse. So I think we have to be cautious and individualize. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, however, if we never do enter the elderly into trials, we'll never evolve a database to fully describe what their toxicity profile is.